Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Science helps us to do all sorts of things. It's going to be the pathway to find us new cures and new treatments and answers to questions we haven't even thought to ask yet, and innovations and the source of new job creation. We should fund science like our lives depend on it, because quite probably they do.
Hello, lovely people of podcasts, and welcome to the show. You're with Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia. And with me in the studio this week is, she can introduce herself,
Misha Schubert, the CEO of Science and Technology Australia.
Misha is a very old and dear friend of mine, and she is an absolute force of nature in terms of her passion for science. And we both discovered, actually, that it is, in fact, Science Week. This week.
It is.
And we are in the middle of a pandemic, self-evidently. And
Timely, one would think.
yes.
Science is important. So, how could we underscore that?
Exactly. Yes. And we can underscore it by just stating the obvious, which is that science has been our salvation during this pandemic. And, and it will also be the way out of it if we ever get there, and let's hope. So anyway, look, there are a million things to talk about. And Misha's group is the peak organisation representing about 80,000 scientists and technologists in Australia. And so we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff in this conversation. We're going to talk about workforce. We're going to talk about why science matters. We're going to talk about whether or not the government prioritises it sufficiently. So anyway, let's just start modestly, Mish. Let's just start with... with the science, let's just tell the listeners, where is science up to at the moment?
Yeah. Well, I think we're at a really fascinating juncture in where we find ourselves in the kind of long sweep of history around science and research, because as you've rightly pointed out, particularly in the last 6 months, we've had this very clear sense that science is important to save lives, to keep us safe, to protect us, to navigate through the biggest, most complex challenges that life can throw at us.
Yeah.
And so the value of science has perhaps never been so clear to us in this moment in history. And I've been privileged to get a chance to go around the country, virtually speaking, of course, through networks in our community, and talk with many of those frontline scientists who are actively doing that work day in, day out. So they're on the front lines of that race for the vaccine hunt through multiple different pathways of technology. They're the mathematical modellers who've been doing the long-run epidemiological modelling that's trying to help us navigate and chart and plan some sensible interventions. They've been doing everything from testing sewage to see if COVID, the virus, is actually moving through populations in a way that's undetected from other ways in which we can pick up where it's headed to. They're looking at how long it lasts on surfaces of different types so that we can actually plan, if we're not quite there with a vaccine, for how we actually continue to manage some kind of semblance of new normal life.
Yep.
And they've been doing all of that. And so in a sense, science has been our absolute saviour during this period. Without science, we'd be lost. And yet at the same time, this pandemic has swung this sort of giant wrecking ball through swathes of our economy and society at large. And it's particularly done so also in our major national scientific institutions, in our universities and our medical research institutes. And so the scientific workforce on whom we are relying to save us is itself battling these big challenges around job losses, wage cuts, and carrying some of that weight of the anxiety and worry through this period that everyone has been navigating through this time. So there's this sort of fascinating kind of interplay of those two things happening concurrently in my mind.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, isn't it, really? And it's sort of a slightly hidden story in the pandemic because, and this is why I was keen for us to talk this through, because a lot of the frontline day-to-day coverage during the pandemic is, you know, how many new infections, what governments have or haven't done in terms of, you know, strategies to flatten the curve, et cetera, et cetera. It's sort of, well, I don't know, what would you call it? It's very transactional. Like people are sort of hanging on practical information and then analysis and interpretation of what's going on. And as you say, there's this kind of strangely invisible workforce kind of grinding along in the background there, trying to make sure humanity gets out on the other side. I mean, I suppose it's not entirely hidden, is it, in the sense of chief medical officers and that's slightly different to your cohort, but in a way we've seen them kind of emerge, you know, come and brief us every day, really, about what's happening. So there's sort of visibility. But, yeah, it's just weird, isn't it?
Some of those people are stepping more into the limelight, I would say. And so you've seen the appointment of Alan Cheng, Professor Alan Cheng in Victoria. He's now acting chief health officer in that state. But he's played this key role as an epidemiological kind of consultant into that AHPPC committee, who I can never remember what the acronym actually is.
Oh, I'm glad.
But
that hilarious?
It's all the chief medical officers, yes, plus some technical experts who advise government on health strategy, essentially, in a major national health crisis. So, you know, he's now more visible as a public figure, a trusted public figure. You've got Professor Paul Young and his amazing team of young vaccine hunters in his lab at University of Queensland, Dr. Keith Chappell and others there who are right out on the forefront of this this quest for a vaccine with one of the leading candidates globally. You've got people like Professor Jodie McVernon and Professor James McCaw at the Doherty Institute in Melbourne. One of our team the other day was quipping of Professor Dan Murphy, of course. Peter Doherty famously Googled Dan Murphy opening hours in the midst of the crisis. You know, but people like that who the public wouldn't have heard of before this crisis, but they now are starting to see them so regularly in media appointments. And part of what I really hope is that we will come to know these names almost as readily as we do sporting figures and celebrities in other fields of endeavour. Because they are brilliant. And the other thing I notice constantly about them is they're exceptionally humble people by and large as well. So prodigious brains the size of planets, but this genuine desire to make the world a better place and bringing that incredible depth of expertise that they've spent lifetimes building, and our country has spent a lifetime investing in their capabilities and expertise as well. We're also quite good as a country at nicking other countries' great talent as well, which is a cheeky kind of Australian science story as well. So we're really great at growing some incredible talents here that are Australian born and bred, but we're also pretty good at looking around the world, and part of this is the story of international students coming to our country to do postgraduate work in particular over decades, and encouraging them to stay and be part of putting their brain power into our scientific endeavour as a country. So I think often of the story of Professor Ian Fraser, who's at the University of Queensland. He's the gentleman, of course, who, along with a Chinese national who came, Dr. Zhang Zhou, who's now passed away, the two of them worked on what would become the Gardasil vaccine against cervical cancer, saving the lives of millions of women and girls eventually across the world by rolling out this sort of vaccine that guards against the papillomavirus. And their insight into it's this virus that causes this led them to a vaccine path for that particular virus. So having that brilliance of talent from other parts of the world harnessed into our system here in this country is really important. But we do find ourselves at a moment, I think, where there's an invitation here for us to think about how do we safeguard that scientific capability for the long haul now, knowing that vulnerability.
Well, let's talk about that. Okay, because it seems strange to me that a government that is very preoccupied with security and with sovereignty, let me step back a bit, right? The pandemic is sort of, it's a global problem, but it's kind of highlighted the vulnerability of global systems. then we've seen this rise of the nation in terms of responses to the pandemic. And that's just been a really interesting dynamic in the pandemic. So we've seen Scott Morrison talking about sovereignty, talking about the pandemic response as an act of sovereignty and an expression of sovereignty. But I never hear about I never, ever hear the government talk about safeguarding Australia's intellectual capacity in those same terms. You know, we've seen this strange, neglect is too strong a word because there has been support for the university sector, but, you know, they've been left outside of JobKeeper. You know, the vice-chancellors are tearing their hair out around the country. What do you make of all of that?
Well, look, I think one thing I would put into that sort of frame for you is Karen Andrews is the Industry and Science and Technology Minister. She has made a number of really key statements across the last couple of months calling for stronger sovereign capability in Australia, not just in a manufacturing context, but thinking about what does sovereign capability in a broader sense look like, and pointing out that she certainly sees a key role for science and technology as enablers of the sort of job creation task that confronts us kind of concurrently with the keeping people safe while we hope and pray that the vaccine hunters can kind of, you know, do their work to successful fruition. So I don't think it's outside of those bounds. I mean, I absolutely think that scientific capability is part of our, you know, national security in a sense, because it's about the capability that we have here within our country to keep people safe and to save lives, which actually probably would fairly fit squarely within that definition. Mm. The point about when we think about sort of investments in the research system as a whole, I'm really interested by having followed quite closely what's been happening in the UK in recent years.
Tell me about that.
So in 2017, the UK government, which is a Conservative government, looked around the world and other advanced economies, so across the OECD group of advanced economies, on average, they invest around 2.4% of the size of their economy into research and development. And that's public investment through governments. It's also private sector and then universities and parts of the public research effort as well. And they were at 1.7%. They had been in a state of decline. And so they basically agreed to have a 10-year plan to really ramp up their in public investment in research and development capability. Mm. So the big fruits of that are starting to kind of wash through their budget processes now under Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the UK. So the last budget just in May, they've had a 15% uplift in R&D investment out of government expenditure. And over the next 3 years, I think it is, it basically doubles to $22 billion in the public investment they're making to snare their country and their economy a bigger share of the future income streams that are going to come from clever R&D innovations. And I'm thinking here particularly around something called deep tech, which is essentially the fancy pants term.
Tell me about deep tech.
Which is basically the inside the beltway term for technology-based innovation companies that are founded out of a scientific insight, essentially.
Right.
So we've got some terrific examples here in Australia as well. There's an incubator out at in Sydney called Cicada Innovations that are part of our membership structure. And their job is to take scientists and engineers and people who are working in all sorts of really incredibly clever scientific innovation and work out how to turn that into an innovation that becomes a product, an income stream, a source of jobs, a clever startup for our country and keep the IP and the returns in Australia.
Can you imagine?
So, you know, more of that at scale I think would be a really clever thing for us to think about as a country and to seize an opportunity here, and particularly as people are starting to have those conversations about, well, how do we create an economic recovery for the country? We should actually put our STEM capabilities as a country squarely in the centre of that frame, because that kind of innovation that comes out of a STEM skill set and those kinds of leaps and bounds in knowledge will give us the kind of high-wage jobs and more secure kind of economic base for the country that I think every Australian would you know, be delighted if we can pull off.
But then think about this, love. A couple of, well, not this election just gone, I think the one before that, Malcolm Turnbull, never a more exciting time. Malcolm Turnbull in that election campaign tried to energise the country around this idea about of Australia sort of, kind of crashing through middle power status, sort of being a powerhouse basically of R&D, of tech, of all of this sort of stuff, the Silicon Valley of this hemisphere or whatever else, right? He was genuinely enthused. You will remember this well. but then afterwards, it seemed in the wash up, because we all remember how that election went, the government hung on by one seat. In the wash up, there seemed to be a quite substantial retreat from the idea of putting brain power at the centre of the Australian economy and industry. Now, I sort of say that flippantly, but what the feedback that people sort of gave us at the time was that people in the community who have been through 30 years of structural adjustment sometimes equate progress, in inverted commas, technological or otherwise, with job destruction. So while our friend Malcolm had never been more excited to tour the incubators of the country, it fell flat. So
I think there might have been a few other things going on in that election too.
I completely agree with you, my love. But I'm trying you and I to nut this one out, right?
So here's where I think there's a broader frame on that conversation, which is around the role that potentially technology and science can play in strengthening and safeguarding some of our traditional industry sectors. So rather than thinking about this as a sort of bifurcated conversation where you sort of say, well, we either do these traditional strengths of the Australian industry, so agriculture and mining and construction and manufacturing, older type manufacturing, or we do the sort of those sort of scientific or other, really high tech innovations, thinking about, well, actually, are there ways in which we can bring that technological innovation into the traditional industry strengths for Australia to modernise, to digitise, to continue to have that be a really important foundational part of our economic mix and the job picture here in our country. And I think there's some really exciting possibilities there that perhaps can land in a frame where people see them not as a departure from our traditional strengths, but as a bolsterer, a strengthener, a set of tools to sustain jobs that are really important in big parts of the country.
Mm. And also, flip side of that, okay, so maybe there's a middle ground is your answer. Maybe there's a way of trying to reassure people that science is a job adder rather than a job subtractor in the prism we're talking about,
and,
right?
And it is. That's what the actual evidence and facts tell us.
You're talking about facts on my show.
Evidence, old-fashioned.
What are you thinking?
Yes.
Okay. So there's a good thought, but then you've also sort of got to occupy, or you've got to refocus political minds on this, and you've rightly pulled me up on Karen Andrews being an advocate for science and the science minister, right? But you've sort of got to, in the middle of a pandemic where politicians are kind of punching through massive days just trying to churn through what needs to happen. Do you think there's enough bandwidth to engage both the public and the political constituency about having another go at never a more exciting time in some sort of rebooted format?
Well, I think we have to seize this opportunity, right? I don't see it as a choice not to, because when we look at the way in which new industry growth is happening globally, those sorts of STEM skill-enabled businesses and sectors are where sort of bigger scale job growth is going to come from. Mm. And these incredibly exciting technologies, some of which are well beyond my sort of specialist expertise, in specific disciplines of the sciences, but the sort of frontier knowledge of things that we couldn't even have imagined 10, 20 years ago that could become treatments and tests and all sorts of innovations are where we will see strong job creation. And then the question for Australia becomes not will there be jobs in those things? Yes, there will be. Mm. There will be. The question for Australia then becomes, are we going to have a share of those jobs? Or are we going to let them happen in other countries that are economic competitors? That's the real choice
us. Well, exactly. That is exactly the choice. But there's also then a lot of back office investment, isn't there? I mean, there are obviously fantastic institutions in this country, brilliant universities, brilliant teaching in those universities, brilliant people in those universities. The sector, and you know, we touched on this a second ago, right? The sector is deprived of income of foreign students at this point. It has struggled massively during the pandemic. It's been laid bare, you know, the sort of workforce patterns in the university sector. A lot of people on casual gigs, you know, not tenured, don't have any job security. And it's sort of like it's a massive task. I'm not talking us down here, sister. To be clear, I'm not talking us down, but I'm just saying, it's not only what emerges at the sort of the front end. We've also got to look at the back end, right? So, you know, it's a big task to try and marshal that focus, I guess.
It is. And I think we've got to keep an eye always through this period on that talent pool so we don't lose valuable skill and capability here through this period. And I know the Treasurer at the start of this talked a lot about sort of bridges to the other side of the pandemic in a different context, talking about sort of keeping the economy moving. But I think there's a useful way of thinking about this. It is about a bridge for our intellectual and scientific capability in this country as well, because we can't afford to lose the incredible talents of our, particularly our research community through this period and have them lost to the research system potentially forever if they fall out of jobs and, you know, this endeavour in this moment. I'm always really struck by a stat that is something like 57%, so nearly 6 in 10 of our university R&D workforce is postgraduate students. And these are people who are, you know, brilliant higher degree students. I know. It's incredible, isn't it? This is in the research report that was done through Alan Finkel's Rapid Research Information Forum group earlier this year. And I sat with that figure a lot because, you know, that's the scale of the work. And these are the people who are doing, like, you know, they're doing their own higher degree, but then they're working in the labs doing, you know, running the experiments, getting that data, making sure that it's all right, you know, working then with the senior published researcher to make sure that that whole research effort in our country keeps moving forward. And, you know, many of them are on a stipend of, wait for it, $28,000 a year.
Commonwealth scholarships, yeah.
Through the research training program that's run through the Department of Education that Dan Tehan has oversight of. It's a terrific program. What great bang for buck we get out of that incredible, talented scientific research workforce. You know, they're across all the disciplines, but I'm more keenly aware and follow the work of the scientific disciplines there. And I just think that's an incredible return on investment that we get. And that's our pipeline of future talent. And if we're serious as a country about saying to younger kids, children in their primary school and high school years now, STEM skills are part of the future. We want you to choose STEM study on the way to STEM careers. I think we've also got to then show them the security of that pipeline kind of into and through that sort of the research sector itself and how job creation will also happen then in STEM-enabled jobs and industries for the country. And you've got to do all those things concurrently in my mind.
Yes, you've got to put it all together. Now, we've touched down on workforce, but we can go deeper, I think. You mentioned, obviously, there is this risk of the brain drain in the sense that and I'm acutely conscious of this as of having kids, you know, young adult kids and the competition in global labour markets in technology and all these kinds of areas. It's just extraordinary, really. When you see, you know, big tech companies coming through Australia, sweeping up the best and brightest of Australian kids, nicking them off to Microsoft for a couple of years. Speaking of an example close to my home, you know, that sort of thing, right? That's obviously IT. That's just one discipline, but it's just, anyway, I'm just very conscious this happens, right? So I know exactly the brain drain you're talking about and the risks associated with a country that doesn't appear sufficiently committed to their endeavour. You know, these kids will go elsewhere. These people will go elsewhere. It is a big problem. So, but recently you surveyed the science workforce in Australia, didn't you, as
yep.
part of one of your exercises for working out where science is, which is where this conversation started. So tell us about that. What did that survey turn up?
So this is something that we do every year, but this year with Professional Scientists Australia and Science and Technology Australia, and we ask a whole range of questions around working conditions and wages and the sort of broader circumstances of scientists across the nation. And this time around, we actually asked them a whole lot of COVID-specific questions about what has been the direct impact of this pandemic on your experience. And perhaps unsurprisingly, one of those key things was that many of those who were parents juggling homeschool, the delights of distance learning supervision at home.
Strangely struggled. Whilst
also trying to maintain a big and serious research job and write grant applications for competitive funding grants, because this is the other sort of cycle in which researchers are, you know, are in.
Tell people a little bit about that, because I reckon a lot of people would have no idea about that.
Yeah.
We'll just pause there briefly. Tell people about that.
So the way research is funded in our country is through this sort of quite Byzantine architecture, really. But there are a couple of big major funding grants pots. So there's some sort of baseline funding that comes into universities and other research institutions. And then they obviously get some money from the private sector to do collaborative research. But a big stream of that income comes in the form of competitive research grants. So the Australian Research Council and the National Health and Medical Research Council have these sort of vast, you know, have a pot of money. And they invite applications from people from researchers to put in kind of collaborative efforts to sort of say, you know, I'd like to be funded for a 3-year project to develop this capability to this next stage of development. Mm. And that goes through a competitive process. There's a rigorous peer review process around that. And then ultimately things get recommended forward for funding. But the strike rate on that is quite challenging for researchers because, and I don't have the immediate figures to hand, but it can be quite a laborious, time-consuming task of writing these incredibly rigorous applications just to renew your funding. And for many researchers, so this is their salary. So it's like, imagine in any other context where you get hired to do a job, but you're actually then having to write,
beg for the money to do the
grant
job.
Yeah. Every couple of years to be able to continue to fund your own salary and that of your team.
Yeah.
And so that's what people face. And they're doing that whole administrative load on top of this incredibly exciting research that they're having to, you know, that they're doing and spending large amounts of their hours on. And then also you throw into the mix being at home
with kids,
with young children, being supervised. So, you know, that's been an enormous part of the lived experience of the science workforce in our country. We also saw that about one in 20 of those who were surveyed said that they'd either had a contract not renewed or had lost a job during this period. Mm. Some had their hours cut, around one in 10. But the one sort of note of optimism in this whole thing, we also asked them about their thoughts on what their assessment was of the general confidence and trust and regard of the public at large for the endeavour of scientists. And a majority of them, sort of around 6 in 10, said that they felt Australians now valued science more. As a consequence of the lived experience of watching science play its incredible role to save lives and be part of the front and centre work of us navigating this extraordinary pandemic.
Well, that's the thing, and maybe this is the point that'll bring us to the conclusion in this conversation. Mm-hmm. It's sort of and it's kind of neatly beginning where we started. It's I've been naysaying in this conversation or reality checking this scale of the endeavour, but maybe the difference between the never more exciting time tour of Australia in 2016 and a reboot of that for contemporary times is maybe science has proved its value to a substantial proportion of the community. Dare we be that hopeful?
Well, I am that hopeful. Science helps us to do all sorts of things. It's going to be the pathway to find us new cures and new treatments and answers to questions we haven't even thought to ask yet, and innovations and the source of new job creation. It helps us to see around corners and to anticipate things well in advance often. And that's been one of the other things out of this experience of this pandemic has been that the preparedness of some of our major science institutions, including the CSIRO and others, to look at kind of scenarios a bit like this over years and years has actually positioned us well. It's still been a crazy experience, right? That capability is extraordinary. So I think, you know, we absolutely need to seize that opportunity. We should fund science like our lives depend on it, because quite probably they do.
Oh, that's a perfect note to end on. Thank you, Mish, for coming on the show. Thank you, as always, to Miles Martignoni, who is my executive producer, and to Hannah Izzard, who often cuts the program. Parliament will be back next week. God help us all for a fortnight of strange COVID sittings. We'll be back with you then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.